From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Annie Ross helped create the singing style called vocalese, and as part of the trio of Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross, she helps popularize it. On this edition of Fresh Air, Annie Ross tells us about her singing career, her days as a child actress, and her recent return to the screen. Also today, a talk with character actor Vincent Gardenia. He played Cher's father in the movie Moonstruck. Rock historian Ed Ward remembers the late Del Shannon. And commentator Patricia McLaughlin wonders why some baby names are in while others are out. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration today repeated its call for the demobilization of Nicaragua's Contra rebels, but added that there must be assurances for their personal and economic security. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
Ever since Mrs. Violeta Chamorro's stunning victory in last Sunday's elections, the political debate in Nicaragua has centered on when and how the Contras should return home. Both Mrs. Chamorro and current President Daniel Ortega have called for the immediate demobilization of the rebels. The U.S. is also anxious to see the rebels return home voluntarily, quote, under safe and democratic conditions. But the Contras have said they will wait to make sure the Sandinistas relinquish control over the country's security apparatus. Today, the State Department announced it will send retired diplomat Harry Schlauterman to Honduras to encourage the Contras to lay down their arms and return home. The State Department also called for the full and unequivocal transfer of power to the newly elected Nicaraguan government. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
South African anti-apartheid leader Nelson Mandela was named today to the number two post in the African National Congress. Mandela was named deputy president of the ANC, partly because of the party's concerns for his health. The 71-year-old leader was recently released from prison after serving 27 years for his anti-apartheid activities. The president of the ANC is Oliver Tambo, who's currently in Sweden, where he's recovering from a stroke. A special prosecutor has been named to look into charges of impropriety leveled against former Housing Secretary Samuel Pierce. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Former federal judge Arlen Adams was sworn in today. Currently a lawyer in Philadelphia, he was appointed by a special three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington. His job is to lead the investigation into whether Samuel Pierce steered millions of dollars of government housing contracts to Republican cronies. Pierce was the only cabinet member who served all 8 years of the Reagan administration. The original request for an independent counsel was made by Democrats in the House of Representatives. They said Pierce had lied under oath during congressional testimony last spring. Last fall, Pierce cited his Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination and refused to testify. His attorney said in a statement that now the investigation can go forward. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
A congressional commission today narrowly approved a plan designed to provide health insurance coverage for all Americans. The bipartisan Pepper Commission plan calls for a mixture of public and private coverage, but it would still cost the federal government $65 to $70 billion a year to be covered by tax increases. By a wider margin, the panel also approved a proposal to cover the costs of long-term nursing home care. Prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed almost 25 points. This is NPR News. The Federal Food and Drug Administration has approved the use of the drug AZT for the treatment of adults infected with the AIDS virus, even if they don't show symptoms of the disease. The drug's been used for 3 years to treat patients who were severely ill with AIDS or related problems. The FDA approved new labels expanding the use of the drug after two federally sponsored studies showed that AZT slowed the progress of the disease in people with early symptoms or none at all. The House Armed Services Committee released a report today that was highly critical of the Navy's investigation into the explosion on board the USS Iowa last April. Elizabeth Arnold has details.
Congressman Nick Mavrulis announced today that his subcommittee found no evidence to indicate that gunner's mate Clayton Hartwig generated the USS Iowa explosion. The Navy concluded months ago that Hartwig was suicidal and had rigged the tragic blast that killed himself and 46 other seamen. The subcommittee ordered its own psychological profile and found that there was no reasonable evidence to lead to that conclusion. Mavroulis accused the Navy of jumping to conclusions and of leaking a story that Hartwick was homosexual to the press. He says the Navy flip-flopped on the technical cause several times, saying that the blast was set off by friction, pressure, a timer, and then a chemical detonator. Saying the Navy's investigation was flawed from day one, Mavroulis says his subcommittee will soon be recommending the establishment of an independent investigative body for the armed services. For National Public Radio, I'm Elizabeth Arnold reporting.
A Washington, D.C. court today released the passport of Dr. Elizabeth Morgan, clearing the way for her to travel to New Zealand to battle for the custody of her daughter, Hillary. Morgan lost her passport and served 2 years in jail when she refused to divulge Hillary's whereabouts and resisted a judge's order that her former husband be allowed unsupervised visits with the child. The case moved to New Zealand last week. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new campy horror film called Basket Case 2. It stars Annie Ross. And yes, it's the same Annie Ross who sang with Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross. Dave Lambert, John Hendricks, and Annie Ross were perhaps the most popular jazz vocal group of the late 50s and early 60s. They did vocalese, that is, their songs put words to jazz instrumental arrangements and improvisations. Some of their songs were reissued last year on the CD Everybody's Boppin'. Annie Ross left the trio in 1962, moved to England, and ran her own club for a couple of years. Since then, she's appeared in many British stage and TV productions, and she's had a couple of small parts in such films as Yanks and Superman 3. But she's done very little singing, and many of her American fans have lost track of her. Ross is living in New York for the time being, and we invited her to talk with us about her recent life and her singing career. Let's get things started with the song she's best known for, Twisted. Ross wrote the lyric to a melody and improvisation by tenor saxophonist Wardell Gray. It's been recorded by Bette Midler and Joni Mitchell. This is Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross.
My analyst told me that I was right out of my head the way he described it.
How?
He said I'd be better dead than live. I didn't listen to his jive. I knew all along he was all wrong, and I knew that he thought
what?
I was crazy, but I'm not. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
My analyst told me
what?
That I was right out of my head. He said I need treatment,
yeah.
But I'm not that easily led. He said I was the type that was most inclined, went out of his sight, to be out of my mind. And he thought I was nuts,
nuts.
No more ifs, or ands, or buts. Oh no.
Oh no.
Oh no.
They say as a child I appeared a little bit wild with all my crazy ideas, but I knew what was happening. I knew I was a genius. What's so strange when you know that you're a wizard at three? I knew that this was meant to be. But I heard little children were supposed to sleep tight. That's why I lay with the vodka one night. My parents got frantic, didn't know what to do. But I saw some crazy scenes before I came to. Now, do you think I was crazy? I may have been only three, but I was swinging. They all have been angry at them. They all have been Edison and also an Einstein. So why should I feel sorry if they just couldn't understand the reason and the logic that went on in my head? I had a brain, it was a pain though, to let them love at me when I refused to ride on all the double-decker buses, all because there was no driver on the top.
No driver on the top.
She must be out of her head.
What's the matter with her?
My analyst told me
what?
That I was right out of my head the way he described it.
Annie Ross, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We just heard Twisted.
Yeah.
I just need to ask you if you were in analysis when you wrote that.
No, I was not and have never been. It was really suggested, the title Twisted suggested to me the whole story of a woman going to an analyst. But no, I wasn't in analysis.
How did you start doing vocalese, putting words to jazz solos?
Well, I went to see a man called Bob Weinstock, who had a record label. And we talked, and he said, you know, have you heard Moody's Mood for Love? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, do you think you could do something like that? And I said, sure. You know, necessity is the mother of invention, and my necessity was need of money. So I took a stack of records home, played them. The one that I really liked was Twisted. And I was back the next morning with the lyrics.
And then you started doing more of it because it caught on so well?
Yes, and I loved the idea. It was really a challenge. It was so different from writing a regular song. And I enjoyed telling a story, having a beginning and a middle and an end, you know.
Did you want to keep singing standards even when you were doing vocalese?
Oh, sure. I mean, I don't think quality diminishes, and you can't beat great songs. I mean, there are some wonderful, wonderful ballads. They don't go out of style. They, you know, come around again after a long time. I got very bored because I had always sung standards, and, you know, I thought, I don't want to sing this anymore or that anymore. But then years pass, and you look at them with a fresh eye, and like I say, the quality is still there, and they're masterpieces.
Let me play a song that you recorded before you teamed up with Lambert and Hendrix. This is from a 1957 session that you made with baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan,
mm-hmm.
and the session has recently been reissued. The title is Annie Ross Sings a Song with Mulligan, and I'm going to play the Dietzen Schwartz song. I guess I'll have to change my plans.
Oh, good.
Well, I guess I'll have to change my plan. I should have realized I'd lose my favorite man. I overlooked that point completely until the big affair began. Before I knew where I was at, I found myself upon a shelf, and that was that. I tried to reach the moon, but when I got there, all that I could get was the air. My feet are back upon the ground, 'cause I've lost the one man that I found.
My guest Annie Ross recorded with Jerry Mulligan. Annie Ross is a singer and actress, and she's now appearing in the new film Basket Case 2. So how did you team up with John Hendrix and Dave Lambert?
Well, I had come over in this review, Cranks, with Anthony Newley, and I happened to be at a friend's house, Bob Bach, and he and his wife Jean Bach were very dear friends of mine. Jean, of course, still is. And they got a phone call from Dave, I think it was. Yeah, that's right, because he knew Bob. And he said, I have this idea about putting words to a Count Basie album. Can I come over, bring John, and demonstrate what we have? I said, sure. So he said, do you want to stick around, Annie, and see what's happening? I said, sure. So round they came. They played one of Basie's numbers. They both sang the solos. I thought, hey, that's great. And the next thing I knew, they asked me if I would come down and conduct some session singers that they had engaged to record about, I think, 4 or 6 tracks. And they said, you know, that the women, they wanted me to give the women the Basie feel. Well, that was a laugh in itself. I mean, you can't teach that to anybody. You have to be born with it, be brought up with it. And I tried, but like I said, you can't just teach that, and especially not in, you know, half an hour or whatever. The upshot was that the session time had, a couple of hours to go on the record session. They had no more that they could do because what they had was not good. They were going to scrap it. And the producer was tearing his hair out and saying, my God, we've lost this money and blah, blah, blah. And Dave Lambert, who was into electronic things, etc., said, well, what about if we multitrack? Well, I said, of course. I didn't know what multitracking was, but I figured I'd better not show my ignorance. Anyway, he then explained what it was. So he said, what we have to do, Annie, we'll get rid of the singers. You, John, and I'll go into a room. We'll rehearse. We'll learn all the harmonies so that we multi-track 4 times. So I said, okay. And, I mean, you know, we all had great ears. We heard the chord sequences. Learning the solos was not that difficult for us. And it was, I think, one of the great moments of my life because we heard the first track back. And that was fine. That was the melody. Then we recorded the second track. They played it with the first track. Well, well, that was something else. Then the third track was unbelievable. The fourth track was mind-blowing. And we knew we had something absolutely great. It was that feeling that we were breaking new ground, that we were creating. And it was exciting, and I felt giddy. I mean, it was just a wonderful, wonderful moment.
So the group stuck together, but most of your stuff was not over track like that. It was mostly just straightforward trio. How would you come up with the arrangements? How were those done?
Well, they were actual arrangements from the bands of that era. We would take, like, Horace Silver, maybe a quintet, a somewhat scaled-down version. We just didn't do the big band things that much, except we did do Ellington.
Well, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is singer and actress Annie Ross. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is singer and actress Annie Ross. From 1958 to 62, she was part of the jazz vocalese trio Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross. She's starred in theater productions and in sitcoms in England and is now starring in the new film Basket Case 2. You left Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross in 1962. This was before the group broke up, and you were actually replaced by another singer, Yolanda Bavon. Why did you leave?
Well, there are many reasons, primarily because I was fed up with going on the road. I really didn't feel that I had any kind of a life. And I wasn't brought up with my family. I felt that I really needed to try to find my roots and kind of find out who I was. And I always loved Europe. I'd spent many years there in Paris. And so I decided I would stay, and I eventually met Sean Lynch, who was an actor who I married, and I said a tuteleur to the United States for a little while.
What were some of the problems you had with life on the road?
Life on the road. Well, for a woman it's quite different than for a man. You never have a chance to establish any relationships because you're going from town to town, traveling. Especially at the time that I was with the group, a woman didn't go downstairs and go into a bar or go into a club on her own to have a drink. I think that's why a lot of singers usually take up with one of the rhythm section, because they're there. But, you know, after a while, the guys, you know, they like you, and they like to hang out with you, but they don't want to hang out with you all the time.
Did you have a slight breakdown, too, when you left Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross?
Well, I wasn't in good health, and I think being on the road also took its toll. And I needed a good rest, mm-hmm. anyway.
Well, once you got to England, for a couple of years, you had your own club called Annie's Place.
Annie's Room.
Annie's
yeah.
Room, thank you. And then after that, I think you started doing stage work and even some television.
I did a lot of television at the same time as having the club. But the club was also very difficult. It bore my name, and the people who went there wanted to see me, which meant I had to be there every night. And it was like every night was a party, you know. I wouldn't go there till, say, 11 o'clock at night. I'd get home about 5. I would sleep until 1 or 2. I mean, it was a crazy, wonderful, but mixed up kind of time in my life.
Annie Ross is my guest. Before we talk about your new movie, I want to talk with you about how you first got started acting in the first place. You came to America from England when you were, I think, 6 years old.
Scotland,
from Scotland.
5 and a half.
Okay.
No, 4 and a half. I was 4 and a half when I arrived.
Now, once you got to America, didn't you stay there with your aunt, the singer Ella Logan?
Yes, I did. I came to New York with my mother and father and my elder brother, and I won a contest, a radio contest. The prize was a six-month, really a token contract with MGM. And I went out to L.A. with my aunt because my aunt started doing films. And then my mother left, my father and mother and brother all went back, and I was raised in Beverly Hills in L.A.
How did you feel about being raised by your aunt and kind of leaving your parents behind?
When I say aunt, she was really my guardian. My aunt was really in New York doing shows, and I was raised by a nanny. And it wasn't great.
Did your parents have any reservations about leaving you?
I'm sure they did. Sure.
Did they want it that way, or was it you who?
I think they probably felt that it was best for me to do that. That maybe through doing that, I could become a star. But they already had stars.
You mean California already had stars?
Sure, they had Shirley Temple and Jane Withers, and you know, many, many young kids.
Well, how were you groomed? What kind of image were you given?
The Shirley Temple image, but with a kilt.
Oh, because you were Scottish.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I had a thick Scottish accent, too.
Well, that must have been rough.
Oh, I think everybody thought it was adorable.
Did you have those little curls?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And did you have to be cute as a button?
Well, I mean, I had no thought of not performing. I mean, I would perform at the drop of a hat. You know, I could swing, and I could sing well, and I could move. And I loved all the attention. I mean, very few children don't like that.
Now, you also did some Our Gang comedies?
Oh, I only did one, yeah.
Oh, okay. And what kind of part did you have in there?
Well, it's a little girl with a kilt who comes out, and they're producing a show, and she sings a swing version of Loch Lomond.
I should have guessed that, shouldn't I?
Yes.
So you had won this mini contract at MGM through the talent show?
Yes.
And when the contract was up, what happened?
That was it. I was up. They had no use for me, and my aunt, who was really my guardian, decided that I needed an education and that she didn't want me to get big-headed and, you know, all those things.
So what happened next?
Well, then I just went to school. And then when I was 16, I came to New York and I went into the Academy of Dramatic Art, the American Academy of Dramatic Art, and stayed there for a year, then went back to Scotland and re-met my family.
What was it like to meet them after not having seen them for so long?
Well, as you can imagine, it was weird. It was very strange. I didn't know them at all. And this is your brother, and this is your brother, and this is your brother, and this is your sister, and this is your aunt, and this is your grandma. Please. You know, I hadn't seen them since I was four. And, I mean, Glasgow was so different from New York, where my aunt had been appearing in Finian's Rainbow. And it was very foggy, and it was cold, and it was rainy, and I just didn't feel I belonged there at all. Now I adore it, but at the time it was a very big culture shock.
How did you start listening to and then performing jazz?
Well, my aunt gave me a record of Ella Fitzgerald singing A Tisket a Tasket when I was four, and I learned it, and I could do it. And a wonderful thing about my aunt was that in our house in L.A., there were always a lot of musicians who hung around. And they were musicians from Duke Ellington's band, indeed, Duke Ellington himself, Roy Eldridge, Earl Garner. And so I moved toward modern jazz as opposed to Dixieland.
Let me jump ahead to 1990 and get to the movie that you're starring in now, which is called Basket Case 2.
Yeah.
Now, this is very unlike anything we've talked about so far in the interview today, as far as I can tell. What this is a really pretty funny, in some ways, pretty campy horror film.
Yes, I think it's great.
And you play...
I play Granny Ruth.
And Granny Ruth runs a home. It's kind of like a community of freaks and mutants, people who were born deformed, who've been taken from freak shows. And it's like a sanctuary for them.
That's right.
And I want to play a clip from this movie. And this is a scene where you've just welcomed someone new to the community of freaks, someone new named Belial, and you're introducing him to the other freaks.
I see.
Let me introduce you to Lorenzo. He comes from South America, born with an oversized head and an underdeveloped body. He was abandoned by his parents, put on display in cheap backroom exhibitions. He also possesses one of the most beautiful voices I've ever heard. Would you, Lorenzo?
Dai campi, dai prate.
Now meet Frederick. I purchased Frederick from his parents.
Yes, purchased. It was either me or a sideshow. He's very, very introverted, very difficult to understand, and the first to offer comfort and help when one of our family needs it.
Annie Ross, how did you get this role?
How did I what?
how did you get this role?
Well, I did what everybody else does. I went up and I auditioned, and...
Did they know who you were?
No, I don't think so. What you do in a case like that, you go up, you stand in front of a video camera, you state your name, and at this point, we didn't have a script, and so, at least a script for the actors to read, so I just... answered questions that were given to me by the lady who was doing the video. I got a phone call from my agent saying they want you.
Do you expect to be singing more? How much do you sing nowadays?
At the moment, I don't sing very much at all, but I am getting... I can feel that kind of restless feeling that says, you should... You know, I mean, I go and see singers a lot. And from them, I get an idea of, oh, now wait a minute. I remember a song that I really loved that I'd like to do. And I'm getting that kind of thirst for it again.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Actress and singer Annie Ross, she's now appearing in the film Basket Case 2. And several of her solo records and her records with Lambert Hendricks and Ross have been reissued on compact disc. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I love the looks of you, the lure of you, the sweet of you, the pure of you, the eyes, the nose, the mouth of you, the east, west, north, and the south of you. I'd love to gain complete control of you and handle even the heart and soul of you. So love at least a small percent of me, do, 'cause I love all of you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Veteran character actor Vincent Gardenia has been performing since he was 5. You may know him best as Cher's father in Moonstruck. But he didn't get his first English-speaking role until he was in his 30s. Until then, he performed with his father's Italian-language theater company. Coming up, a talk with Vincent Gardenia. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers Del Shannon, the singer who gave us Runaway and Hats Off to Larry. Shannon recently committed suicide. And Patricia McLaughlin talks about kids' names, why there's fewer Susans and Bills and more Jessicas and Jasons. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The West German government has now added a new element into the controversy over guarantees for Poland's western border. A West German government spokesman said today that a treaty between a unified Germany confirming Poland's western borders must also rule out German war reparations to Poland. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from West Berlin.
Today's offer from the West German government is the latest in a week of give and take between Warsaw and Bonn. The Polish government's official reaction to today's offer was astonishment. An official spokesman said, Poland does not want to link the border question with any other problems. Poland had asked for legally binding guarantees for its western border with neighboring Germany. Poland wanted those guarantees before unification. The German chancellor rejected the Polish proposal. Today is the counteroffer. A West German government spokesman said any treaty with Poland should be linked with a pledge to protect the rights of the German minority in that country. West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl has come under intense criticism for his stand on the Polish border in the United States and in Western Europe. In West Berlin, this is Deborah Amos.
The African National Congress has decided the future role of Nelson Mandela. Today, the executive committee, meeting in Lusaka, named him deputy president. The ANC also announced plans to set up headquarters in Johannesburg as soon as possible. Patricia Goulding, the BBC, has more.
Mr. Mandela's former law firm partner, Mr. Oliver Tambo, who is recovering from a stroke in Sweden, remains president. But in his absence, Mr. Mandela's new position will enable him to assume the mantle of leader and so remove the leadership vacuum that followed Mr. Tambo's illness last August. The ANC said the transfer of its headquarters from Lusaka to Johannesburg would take place without delay. It's the ANC's intention to establish the movement as a legal organization within South Africa quickly, and to do this, the ANC is appealing to its international allies for financial assistance. The ANC wants to finalize the arrangements for its delegation to see President de Klerk as soon as possible to discuss the obstacles blocking negotiations. Mr. Mandela said he was optimistic that they could be overcome in due course.
Patricia Goulding, the BBC in Lusaka. In the United States, travel plans have been interrupted for a lot of people across the country because of a strike against Greyhound bus lines. More than 9,000 workers went out on strike after talks failed to find agreement on a new contract. Contract talks between the union and the company, which was bought by private investors back in 1987, began last November. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 25 points to close at 2,660.36 on volume of some 164 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. When singer and songwriter Del Shannon killed himself last month, most of the obituaries and appreciations focused on his 1961 hit Runaway and his other popular songs Keep Searchin' and Hats Off to Larry. There were other significant markers in Shannon's career as well. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward pays tribute to Del Shannon.
Last week, I was tempted for the first time in ages to buy the National Enquirer because, according to a box on its front page, inside it had the real reason Del Shannon killed himself a few weeks ago. But Billboard, a more reliable publication, said simply that he was depressed, and that made sense. After all, he was usually thought of in conjunction with something he didn't play, namely this. Thank you. That catchy hook, played on a primitive electronic instrument called the musitron, came about one night in 1960 at the Hilo Club in Battle Creek, Michigan, where Shannon's band was popular. Max Crook, who had the musitron, was a friend of the band who sat in from time to time. On this particular evening, Shannon heard something and subjected the audience to what was essentially a rehearsal right on stage while he ran through the chords that would soon become famous and created the record that would be his first hit. In many ways, Del Shannon's professional life was like a lot of other tales of Midwestern rockers in the early pre-Beatles 60s. He'd been born in 1939 and named Charles Westover. His stage name was taken from a guy he knew who was going to use the name Mark Shannon for his wrestling career, but never did, and a Coupe de Ville, which I guess he thought sounded like Del. Shannon played country, rockabilly, Roy Orbison hits, and got locally famous. When disc jockey Ollie McLaughlin heard Runaway, though, he put Shannon and Max Crook in touch with a couple of guys with connections in New York, and before he knew it, he had a number one hit. The next one also got to number five.
Hats off to Larry, he broke your heart, just like you broke mine when you said we must part. He told you lies, now it's your turn.
Two records in 1961, and that's it, isn't it? In the U.S., that's almost the story, but late in 1962, another record, written by Roger Miller, got some action in England.
One time, a long time ago, on a mountain in Switzerland, yo, la, 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 there lived a fair young maiden, lovely but lonely, yo-ho-ho.
The Swiss Maid wasn't very good, but went to number two in England, which would make Shannon a perennial attraction there, and, even more importantly, got him a tour at a crucial time. It was obvious that he'd been thinking along the same lines as some of the British bands, and one record, cut before Shannon had ever heard the Beatles, has some very Beatlish chords in it.
Here she comes.
Here she comes.
That little town flirt.
Here she comes.
You're falling for her. And you're gonna.
Hastily resurrected by his record company after the Beatles hit, Little Town Flirt made it to number 12 in the height of Beatlemania. By this time, though, Del Shannon had toured with the Beatles and became the first American to record one of their songs. Unfortunately, what looked like the fast track to superstardom got derailed as Shannon sued the men who'd signed him, claiming that the contract wasn't exactly written with his welfare in mind. He toured England and bided his time, but the smoke didn't clear till 1966, by which time he'd been long forgotten over here. He recorded a lot, but to no avail. In England, he met Rolling Stones producer Andrew Luke Oldham and recorded a whole album with Oldham producing. The record company wouldn't release it. Disgusted, Shannon became a producer himself, and in 1969 was ready to do an album with Smith, a group he'd discovered. The project went to somebody else, but the hit bore Shannon's arrangement at least. It was England and the oldies circuit. In 1981, a longtime Del Shannon fan named Tom Petty produced an album for him, and for a minute, Del Shannon found himself back on the charts.
Come with me, my love, to the sea, a sea of love. I want to tell you how much I love you.
But he'd had problems with the bottle and problems with his marriage. The new fame didn't last. Reportedly, he'd been working on another album with another longtime fan, Jeff Lynne, and in fact, I think he would have made a superb traveling Wilbury in Roy Orbison's place. But instead, with the pull of a trigger, we lost a sadly underrated performer with a great voice and a superb pop sense.
Ed Ward is Fresh Air's rock and roll historian.
We gotta keep searching, searching. Find a place to hide, searching, searching. She'll be by my side if we gotta keep on the run.
This is Fresh Air. In the hit film Moonstruck, Vincent Gardenia played Cher's loving Italian father, for which he received an Oscar nomination. He also got an Oscar nomination for his part as a baseball team manager in the 1973 film Bang the Drum Slowly. He was featured in the films Where's Papa, Little Murders, and Little Shop of Horrors. On TV, he played Archie Bunker's neighbor, and he received a Tony Award for his supporting part in the Neil Simon play Prisoner of Second Avenue. In a recent HBO movie, Age Old Friends, Gardenia and Hume Cronin played best friends living in a retirement home. The character played by Gardenia was losing his memory. I asked Vincent Gardenia if that role forced him to think about getting old.
I've been thinking about this a long time because I've been watching and witnessing the progress of old age. Sometimes it's a progress, sometimes it's a regress. I've seen my father pass away and many of the old-timers as they're getting older, and now as things have gotten modern and much better, I think they've gotten worse because as you get older, you're institutionalized, you're sent to a home, the families are apart. So it's become a longer life, but I think it's become much harder. So I've been thinking about it, not only now, but it's quite a few years that I've been thinking about this. It's not that good.
You know, I think it's usually difficult for older actors to find good parts. But with you, you've become better known in your 60s than you've ever been before.
Yeah, thank God. That's because I think it's that I've done so much work. And when you put it all together, it's like one big, gigantic jigsaw puzzle. One piece went with the other, and one piece went with the other. Until finally, after so many years, you put the piece together, it's, oh, there it is. And that's why I've gotten more recognition as I got older. And in the last 4 or 5 years, it's been tremendous.
Let me ask you about one of the recent roles that a lot of people know you for, and that's Moonstruck, in which you played Cher's father. You played an Italian-American, and I was wondering what kind of thought you put behind how to do the kind of Italian-American hand gestures in this. Do you know what I mean? Like how much to put in without it going overboard.
That was a big stretch, you know, playing an Italian.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think that, for me, I must say, was one of the easiest roles that I've ever played. Without knowing, unconsciously, you do those gestures or that inflation or that infection of the voice, you know? It's just that you've lived that life so long, and I've been with the Italians, Italian families. I always lived at home, and my family, we always spoke Italian. That's my first language.
Mm-hmm. Now, you got an Academy Award nomination for your role in Moonstruck.
Right.
You got your first Academy Award nomination for Bang the Drum Slowly,
yes,
where you played the manager of a baseball team, and the players included Robert De Niro and Michael Moriarty.
Yes.
Would you describe your character and what you liked about playing that role?
Well, you know, very, very funny about that role, or strange. As I said, being an Italian all my life, as a child, I grew up in Brooklyn, and we never went to ball games. I never been to a ball game in my life until 1977 when the Yankees won the World Series in Yankee Stadium. So when I was offered this role, I knew nothing about baseball whatsoever except, you know, seeing it on television now and then. But I knew nothing about, you know, the penalties, the errors. I knew that there were 3 strikes and you're out and, you know, 11 innings or what is it, 9 innings, whatever it is. So I didn't know much about it. And I had never been to a ball game. So when I met these people, the producer, Maurice Rosenfeld, and the director, John Hancock, I told my agent to tell them that I would not discuss the way I would interpret this role, because I work very, very methody, and I don't like to divulge my secrets. Because if they would have asked me something, I wouldn't know what to say. So they accepted that. And when I went on the show, did the movie. In fact, the first day we were out on at Central Park, just rehearsing, you know, and the director said, you know, let's all throw the ball. Let's get to get know each other. Let's have some fun. Says, Vince, whenever you want to jump in. I says, no, I'm playing the manager. You know, the manager is always on the outside. I figure if I get in this game, I'm going to get hit by a ball or something, you know. And in fact, then when we shot in Yankee Stadium, the first scene that morning, we were all in the dugout, my team, De Niro, Moriarty, and Phil Foster and all. And the director says, you all line up here, put your hands over your heart, and we sing the Star-Spangled Banner. And as it's over, everyone goes out to their bases. And Vince, when they're all in their bases, you leave the dugout, go to third base, and speak to the third baseman. I says, gotcha. As he left, I turned to the actor next to me. I says, where's third base? And he thought I was kidding. I said, no, I know where it is on television, but here I don't know where it is. He said, well, it's over there. But, you know, he thought I was joking. I said, no, I don't know anything about it. And the only reason I was able to function in that role is because the character that I thought of in that movie was, I thought that the ball team was, they were all my children. It was like a father. So more than a ball game, I treated it as a family, and that sort of worked, I think, you know.
How did you manage to avoid going to a baseball game all those years growing up in Brooklyn?
Well, I wasn't interested in baseball at that time. I was working with my dad in the Italian Theater. We used to work 6-7 days a week. And we used to tour the 5 boroughs in Brooklyn, the Bronx, New York. Then we'd go out of state. And when I was outside, I rather enjoyed playing stickball or kicking the can, playing dice, you know, the corner street games. And but I mainly, my friends were at that time, even then, were all the Italian actors. So, you know, they weren't interested in baseball. And we wouldn't listen to baseball on radio because at that time, on radio, we had Italian programs, Italian soap operas, which when I got to be about 14, 15, I became an Italian radio actor doing soap operas in Italian. So we were interested in that kind of, those kind of programs, not sports, not games. My father didn't speak English. My mother didn't speak English. They weren't just into sports, you know. That's why I managed to miss the games.
Now, you were actually born in Naples, Italy.
Yes.
You moved with your family to the States, I think, when you were 2 years old. And as you've said, you acted in the Italian theater when you got older. Now, did your father run his own company?
Yes, my father. It was called the Gennaro Gardini Dramatic Company. And it was like the Jewish theater, you know. We had our own company. We were about 20 people. And we would start with, it was really a 4-hour show, almost 4 hours. We would start with vaudeville, then we'd do a 3-act play, and then close with a commedia dell'arte farce. So we would travel from borough to borough, state to state, and put on the shows. And it was his company, and he used to book the shows, he used to write the shows, he directed the shows. Then as he got older, and I got older myself, I started to take over to book the shows and direct the shows. And you know, I was participating more and more in the business area and the acting area.
How old were you when you started acting?
I was 5.
That's pretty young.
Yeah, very young.
You know, a lot of kids of immigrant parents resent their parents' old country ways and rebel against them. I guess you never went through a phase like that.
No. Being actors, my father was very, very well liked in this country. I'm talking like Willie Loman now. They really adored my father, so consequently, we were always treated royally by our neighbors, our friends, and the wherever we went. So I never felt that kind of you know, discrimination. So it was, I had a wonderful childhood with my parents. We had actors at our house all the time. There were parties all the time. The wine was flowed freely, you know, from the age of 5 at the table, and the lasagna and the singing and the it was a joyous time. In fact, I had more fun then than now. I miss those days a great deal.
How old were you when you got your first English speaking part?
Oh, how old was I? I was about, I must have been in my 30s. I started off Broadway in The Man with the Golden Arm, and from 56 until now, I must have done, you know, maybe 30 or 40 plays on and off Broadway. I must have done maybe 40 movies, and not counting the TV appearances, you know.
Do you think that your father would have liked to act in English-speaking movies or on the English-speaking stage?
Oh, yes, very much so. My father was a wonderful actor, but not being able to speak the language, he never tried it, and he didn't want to be embarrassed by not speaking well or, you know, not coming off well. Being that he was a major star in the Italian theater, I think he would have loved it, you know.
How come your parents never learned to speak English?
Because they were so successful in the Italian theater. My father was so successful, you know, he did so well. And why leave it when you're doing that well? My father came to this country, and after 4 years, you know, without speaking the language, without a dollar in his pocket, he was able to call, send for my mother and myself, and he bought a one-family home, and he lived very, very good. We lived very well all our lives. Never millionaires, never rich, but always well. So there was no need to go out and venture into something else.
You still live in Brooklyn now?
Oh, yes, I still live. I've been in this house where I am now for 34 years.
And what keeps you there?
The community, the neighbors, the remembering my family lived there. A lot of wonderful thoughts and a lot of good people. A lot of stores where I shop, and they know me. The mechanic knows me, the doctor knows me, the priest knows me, the neighbor knows me. The garbage people, you know, they take my garbage, they put it back. I'm in good hands with Brooklyn and all state.
Vincent Gardenia, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Actor Vincent Gardenia. This is Gardenia and Cher sipping champagne at the kitchen table in Moonstruck.
You look tired, Pop.
So what's your news?
I'm getting married.
Again?
Yeah.
You did this once before, it didn't work out.
But the guy died.
And what killed him?
He got hit by a bus.
No, bad luck. Your mother and I were married 52 years. Nobody died. You were married, what, 2 years? Somebody's dead. Don't get married again, Loretta. It don't work out for you. Who's the man?
Johnny Camerari.
Johnny Camerari? He's a big baby. And why isn't he here with you telling me this?
Because he's flying to Sicily. His mother is dying.
More bad luck.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Japan's Prime Minister Toshiki Kaifu comes to the U.S. for trade talks with President Bush. We'll talk with Nora Bustani of the Washington Post. She's left Beirut after reporting on the civil war there for many years. Susan Stamberg tells us about new ways to teach Shakespeare to young students. The teachers and the students go to the Folger Shakespeare Library, and on the stage of the theater there, they put on a Shakespeare play. Also, some old George Gershwin piano tunes recorded by the composer himself playing the player piano. These roles were discovered not long ago, and they're played today on digital piano.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Remember when kids had names like Jane, Joan, and Susan, John, Bobby, and Stewie? Commentator Patricia McLaughlin reflects on some of the changes in the name game.
When some friends of mine were pregnant a couple of years ago, we tried to talk them into calling the baby Wrigley, partly in honor of their Chicago roots and partly because their last name is Field. They wouldn't go for it. They wanted a family name. They just couldn't decide which one. The prospective grandfather got so tired of hearing about it, he suggested naming the kid after some useful household object with no family connections or upscale connotations or anything. Double boiler, for instance. Run into enough little girls named Tiffany and Brittany, and the unpretentiousness of double boiler starts to sound pretty good. It's also not a name a lot of other kids will have. I know a Caitlin who's in first grade this year. When she was born, her parents didn't want to call her Jennifer or Lisa like everybody else. They figured nobody but Dylan Thomas fans would think of Caitlin. And were they ever wrong? Their daughter keeps running into other six-year-old Caitlins. This used to happen more. Between 1600 and 1800, half the people living in English-speaking countries were named William, John, or Thomas, or Elizabeth, Mary, or Anne. You can tell their parents weren't heavily into originality, glamour, and stylishness. It's different today. You can't expect people who buy halogen lamps and designer bath towels to give their kids generic names. Rosalind Carter explained her name once by saying that in the South, Poor people often felt like the only thing they had to give their children was a wonderful romantic name. A couple of years ago, I met a lady in East Arkansas whose given name was Romeo Juliet. You can't get more romantic than that. I guess it's elitist, but I'd rather be named for a Shakespeare play than for a character on Dynasty or The Young and the Restless. Not to mention a jewelry store. I mean, Tiffany's an okay name for a pop singer or a cocktail waitress. But what if the kid wants to do particle physics or arbitrage? Besides, soap opera names like Brittany and Jessica and Brooke are too old for little kids. It's everywhere, too. Now that Dallas is on TV all over the world, you can even run into little Sue Ellens in the Via Veneto. Wouldn't it be better to just name them after their grandmothers? Well, unless their grandmothers are named Bertha or Gertrude or Hortense. Actually, a lot of parents now seem ready to compromise. They're looking for names that are traditional, but still kind of cool. Irish couples are going for Aaron or Shannon or Sean. More upscale than plain old Kathleen and Kevin, but not as outright peculiar as, say, Columkill. You see the same thing with biblical names. Lots of Rebeccas, Adams, Davids, Joshuas, Jareds, and Jonathans. But not that many Hezekiahs or Ahabs, and hardly any Jezebels. But the coming thing looks like really ordinary names, almost as unglamorous as Double Boiler. Remember, Fergie and Prince Andrew named their daughter Beatrice, a grandmotherly name that's been out of style since the 1930s. I bet by the time the Lindsays and Brittanys and Tylers are in high school, their names will sound embarrassingly fancy and dated, and you know how constitutionally discontented high school girls are. They'll probably hate them.
Patricia McLaughlin is a syndicated columnist who writes about style for the Philadelphia Inquirer magazine. Naomi Person produces our commentaries and music reviews. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce our interviews. Our production assistants are Joan Tui and Roberta Shirock. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Lester Brown of the World Watch Institute shares the results of their 1990 State of the World report evaluating global environmental health. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new telemovie on the life of writer Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.